Have you ever had this very specific, just incredibly unsettling feeling?
Oh, I think I know where you're going with this.
Right, like it usually happens when you finally get a quiet moment. Maybe you're sitting in your car after pulling into the driveway,
Yeah.
or you're just staring at the ceiling at 2 in the morning.
The classic 2 a.m. spiral, yeah.
Exactly. And you're thinking about your day and you hit your targets, right?
Yeah.
You send all the emails, you led the meetings, you managed the household. You did basically exactly what was expected of you.
On paper, you're doing great.
On paper, you are crushing it. By all outward metrics, you're highly capable. You're checking every single box of success. I mean, if someone were to look at your resume or, your LinkedIn profile or just watch you at a dinner party, they would think, wow, they really have it all together.
Right, they see the polished version.
But secretly, quietly, just beneath the surface of all that bulletproof competence, you feel like you are completely falling apart, like you're what we're calling today a functioning stranger.
Yeah, and that is a profound, almost invisible dissonance. It's that agonizing gap between the face you present to the world and the chaotic, just deeply exhausted reality of your internal
It's
experience.
exhausting, right?
Beyond exhausting. It is the feeling of being an imposter in your own successful life. Like you're just waiting for the other shoe to drop, waiting for everyone to realize that you are actually hanging on by a thread.
Well, if you are nodding right now, if you're listening to this deep dive and feeling maybe a little bit exposed, you are not alone.
Definitely not alone.
And more importantly, you're not fundamentally broken.
Yeah.
Because today, our mission for this deep dive is to unpack a master map of human behavior. We are working from this incredibly dense, fascinating briefing note for a book trilogy.
It's called The Agentic Self by Neil W. Smith.
Yes, and this isn't just, another self-help theory. It's a conceptual roadmap that traces this single continuous arc through the exact exhaustion we're talking about.
It's brilliant because it moves from that agonizing gap between knowing what to do and actually doing it.
Which is the worst feeling.
The absolute worst. And it traces that gap all the way through the extreme behavioral hijacks that it creates. And then finally, it gets to this realization of how to structurally rebuild a life.
Structurally rebuilt. That's the key right there. Because the material here forces a massive paradigm shift. I am so pumped to get into this because it completely changes how we view our inner struggles.
It really does. I mean, for generations, we've been conditioned to view our struggles, that gap between who we are and who we mean to be, entirely through a moral lens.
Right. Good versus bad.
Exactly. When you are highly intelligent and highly capable, yet you constantly fail to execute on your own intentions, your immediate reflex is to hand yourself a moral
No,
verdict.
totally. You look in the mirror and you just say, I'm lazy, I'm weak.
I lack willpower, I'm fundamentally flawed.
But that is the exact trap, isn't it? The author explicitly rejects that moral verdict. There is a line in the briefing note that honestly completely rewired how I think about this.
The engine quote.
Yes. He writes, "You are not lazy, you are not weak, you are a Ferrari engine running on a bicycle transmission."
It's such a brilliant distillation of the problem. It perfectly captures the sheer mechanical mismatch happening inside the brain.
Mechanical mismatch, yeah. I kept thinking about it in terms of like computer hardware.
Okay, tell me about that.
Well, imagine you're trying to run an incredibly advanced state-of-the-art operating system, right? The software code is beautiful, it's brilliant. It can process complex algorithms, predict outcomes, manage massive amounts of data.
So that's the Ferrari engine.
Right. But you are forcing that beautiful software to run on physical hardware that has a burnt-out motherboard and like 2 megabytes of RAM.
Oh, wow.
And when the computer inevitably crashes, when the screen freezes, right, when you need it most, you sit there and scream at the software for being lazy.
Right, you're blaming the code for not trying hard enough.
Exactly. But the code isn't the problem at all. The physical architecture supporting the code is structurally incapable of handling the output.
And that physical limitation, that is the daily reality for the target persona of this material.
The functioning stranger.
Right. The text specifically focuses on the high-achieving, often gifted, or twice exceptional adult. Sometimes you see this abbreviated as 2E.
Right, 2E.
These are people whose cognitive engines just run incredibly hot. They possess deep analytical capabilities, profound empathy, really high-level problem-solving skills. But,
There's always a but.
right, but historically, human beings have spent millennia obsessing over duty, virtue, honesty, willpower. So when a system breaks down in human behavior, Our cultural reflex is to view it through the lens of sin or moral weakness.
It's just so much easier for society to label someone as, you know, bad or lazy or undisciplined, rather than actually map out the complex invisible mechanics of their internal architecture.
Exactly. Because blaming the software gives us the illusion of control.
Oh, that's so true. If I'm just lazy, then the solution is super simple. I just need to try harder.
Wake up earlier.
Buy a new planner. Drink more green juice.
Right, but trying harder on a broken transmission?
It just strips the gears even more. You end up redlining the engine until it smokes, and the bicycle wheels still aren't turning.
Which brings us to what Neil W. Smith calls his master move. Across this entire trilogy, the author performs the exact same intellectual maneuver.
It's so smart.
It really is. He takes something we normally explain morally, like weakness of will or procrastination, powerlessness, even severe addiction, and he redescribes it structurally.
He replaces the vocabulary of sin and virtue with the vocabulary of architecture. Blueprints, scaffolds, foundations.
Which changes literally everything about how you approach your own mind. It means that mental health or human flourishing becomes an issue of coherence, not virtue.
Coherence, not virtue. I love that. So if your life is falling apart, it's not because your soul is corrupt and you need to, you know, confess your sins to become a good person.
No, it's because you're a system that has a healthy baseline, sure, but also very characteristic failure modes and an urgent need for deliberate structural reconstruction. Rebuilding your life becomes a process of engineering.
And an engineer doesn't moralize a collapsing bridge.
Exactly. An engineer doesn't stand in front of a cracked foundation and say, oh, you bad, lazy concrete.
Bad concrete.
Right. The engineer asks, how is the load bearing distributed? Where is the shear stress? How is this machine operating?
How is my machine operating? I mean, I cannot overstate how liberating that question is for anyone listening. It strips away all that toxic shame that keeps people stuck.
It takes the heavy moralistic judgment completely out of the equation and replaces it with clinical curiosity.
You get to just pop the hood of your own life and start looking at the wiring. And this is a big but. If we are going to act like mechanics, we need to know what we're actually looking at.
Right. We need to know why that high-performance Ferrari engine is breaking the bicycle transmission in the first place.
So to understand that breakdown, we have to look at the exact neurobiology of the intention-action gap, which brings us to the primary territory of the first book in the map.
Appropriately titled, Living and Lying.
Living and Lying. So the agonizing distance between a brilliant mind and inconsistent action is not a personality quirk. It's neurological.
The text maps the neurobiology of the gifted or ADHD brain, describing it as having immense high output but critically low throughput.
Okay, let's get really specific here because this is where the whole lazy myth gets totally dismantled by actual biology. The briefing note points to three distinct measurable neurological conditions.
Yes. Low tonic dopamine, an easily exhausted prefrontal cortex, and a reward system that is aggressively, almost violently tuned for novelty.
Let's walk through what each of those actually feels like in a lived experience, starting with tonic dopamine. What is that?
Well, tonic dopamine is the baseline level of dopamine circulating in your brain. Think of it as the steady, low-level hum of motivation that allows a neurotypical person to just engage with routine, mundane tasks.
Okay.
But in a gifted or ADHD brain, that baseline hum is abnormally low.
So it's like living in a house where the voltage is just too low to turn on the lights.
That's a great way to put it.
So the everyday mundane tasks, like folding the laundry, paying a parking ticket, responding to an email that just says, you know, thanks, received. It feels incredibly physically understimulating.
It feels like trying to walk through waist-deep mud.
Because there's literally no chemical reward for doing them.
Exactly. To get the dopamine hit required to initiate an action, this specific brain's reward system demands novelty. It needs something new, exciting, highly complex, or urgently stressful.
It needs a spike.
Right. It requires a spike in phasic dopamine, the sudden burst, just to reach the baseline level of functioning that other people just enjoy naturally every day.
Which perfectly explains the classic paradox of the functioning stranger.
It really does.
It explains why you can hyper-focus on a brand new, incredibly complex crisis at work, right? Mm-hmm. You're coding a new software architecture for 14 hours straight without eating or blinking. But you cannot bring yourself to put a stamp on an envelope and walk it to the mailbox.
The crisis provides the novelty and the adrenaline spike required to move the transmission. The envelope does not.
Wow. And that dynamic is compounded by the third factor, right? The easily exhausted prefrontal cortex.
Yes. Your prefrontal cortex is the executive center of your brain. It is responsible for planning, organizing, regulating impulses, and essentially forcing you to do things you don't want to do.
The adulting center.
Exactly, the adulting center. But because the baseline dopamine is so low, this brain has to use sheer brute force executive function to get through a normal day. It has to manually override the lack of motivation constantly.
Oh, man. It's like driving a manual car, but the clutch is incredibly heavy. Like, every time you shift gears, it takes immense physical strength.
Precisely. And that battery drains incredibly fast. When that prefrontal cortex tires out, which is usually by, like, 2:00 p.m. after a morning of pretending to be normal in corporate meetings, your ability to force yourself to do unstimulating tasks simply evaporates.
It's just gone.
Completely gone.
Yeah.
So when you combine a deep neurological craving for novelty with a completely exhausted executive control center, you get the intention-action gap.
And the author emphasizes this so heavily. Knowing was never the problem. The knowledge is perfectly intact. The execution is what's blocked by the wiring.
Right. So the idea that you know better and do worse because you just don't care enough is factually, biologically false.
That is just such a relief to hear. But there's a layer underneath this gap that I find even more fascinating. It has to do with how we actually perceive reality itself.
Yes, the self model.
Yeah, because if we're going to fix the machine, we need to understand the operating system. And the text introduces a concept here about the self model that is genuinely mind-bending.
It forces us to confront a fundamental illusion about human perception. See, most of us walk around assuming our perception is like a video camera.
Right.
We think our eyes and ears are live streaming objective reality directly into a little theater in our minds where a self sits and watches the screen. But neuroscience tells us that perception is actually a top-down construction. It is predictive.
Predictive.
Yeah.
Okay, and the author uses a really powerful metaphor here. He says the mind doesn't see the glass, it looks through it.
Right.
The mind doesn't see the glass, it looks through it.
Hmm.
Let's unpack that, because it means that the self you experience every single minute of the day, the voice in your head, the feeling of meanness, it isn't a raw reflection of reality, it's a simulation.
It is a working model. Your brain takes in fragmented sensory data from the outside world, makes lightning-fast predictions based on past experiences, and constructs a model of who you are, what the world is, and what is about to happen next.
And then you inhabit that model. You live inside the simulation your brain just built.
Yes. And the critical vulnerability here is that if you are living inside a model, that model can be profoundly flawed. It can be built on really bad data.
Which is the engine of a self-fulfilling failure complex.
Exactly. If your brain has spent years building a model of the self that says, I am a failure who cannot follow through, your brain will actually operate through that lens.
It will literally filter out contradictory evidence. Like the fact that you successfully completed a massive project last week,
yeah,
and just ignores it.
It ignores it, and it magnifies every tiny mistake to reinforce the model. Because the brain wants the model to be correct more than it wants you to be happy.
Wow. It wants the model to be correct more than it wants you to be happy. That's terrifying.
It is.
So the briefing note breaks down the architecture of this self-model into a triad. Three interconnected pillars. Knowledge, values, and agency.
And this triad is arguably the single most connective structural idea in the entire project. Let's look at how they interlock.
Okay.
First, you have knowledge. This is your ability to perceive reality accurately, to understand facts, consequences, and causal relationships.
The facts.
Right. Second, you have values. Now, this isn't just moral values. This is what carries felt motivational weight for your brain. It's what your brain actually cares about in a biological sense.
Okay, got it.
And third, you have agency. This is your sense of authorship. It's your volitional control, your ability to translate what you know and what you value into physical action in the world.
Okay, so let's put this into a real-world scenario just to ground it.
Yeah.
Let's say you need to file your taxes, and you are terrified of the IRS.
A very common fear.
Very common.
Yeah.
So the knowledge pillar is, I know my taxes are due on April 15th, and I know the penalty for not filing.
Right.
The values pillar is, I value my financial security, and I deeply, deeply fear going to prison.
Yes.
If the system is healthy, knowledge and values combine to trigger agency. You sit down, you open the software, and you file the taxes.
But in the brain we are describing, the brain with the exhausted prefrontal cortex and the dopamine deficit, this triad, fractures under stress.
Right.
The knowledge is crystal clear. You know the deadline. The values are intensely felt. You are terrified of the consequences, but the agency pillar completely collapses. You stare at the tax forms on your desk. Your heart is pounding with anxiety, but you physically cannot make your hand pick up the pen.
The knower and the doer have become completely separated.
Separated, yes.
Now, the text notes that in a healthy system, this triad is scaffolded. It's held together by social identity. Our relationships help keep the pillars aligned. But when you're a functioning stranger, your social identity is compromised.
Right.
Because if someone is structurally wired this way, if their triad is constantly fracturing behind closed doors, how on earth are they surviving in the world? We established at the very beginning that these are high-achieving people. They're leading board meetings, paying mortgages, raising kids. If their internal engine is stalled out, how are they moving forward?
By lying.
By lying. And we need to be very careful with that word because the author isn't using it in like a sociopathic sense.
No, exactly. When the text titles the first book Living and Lying, it is not describing a malicious con artist trying to defraud people. It is describing the agonizing full-time secondary job of performing a competence that the inside does not actually feel.
It's a survival mechanism.
It is entirely a survival mechanism.
Faked competence as a full-time job. I mean, it's like you're a duck gliding smoothly across a pond. Above the water, everyone sees a calm, collected professional. But beneath the water, your feet are paddling so furiously they're starting to bleed just to maintain the illusion of forward momentum.
That's a perfect analogy. Because you lack the natural executive function to do things smoothly, you build a mask. You use your high intelligence to mimic the executive function you lack.
You're just brute forcing it.
Yes. You rely on sheer adrenaline, last-minute panic, or desperate people-pleasing to force your brain into action. You wait until 3 hours before a massive presentation to start building the slide deck, using the absolute terror of public humiliation to spike your dopamine high enough to get it done.
Oh, man. So many people are going to relate to that.
Because you project the image of a highly capable professional, but internally you know the truth. You look through the glass of your self model and you know the image you are projecting is completely disconnected from the crumbling architecture underneath.
And the toll that takes. I mean, the sheer caloric burn of holding up that mask every single day, to wake up every morning, put on a costume of competence, go into the world and smile, while knowing that at any moment, someone might look closely enough to see that the building is completely empty.
The anxiety of that must be crushing.
Crushing.
And it is entirely biologically unsustainable.
Yeah.
A system cannot run in a state of constant faked emergency forever. The prefrontal cortex eventually gives out completely. The adrenaline receptors fry.
And that brings us to the inevitable, terrifying breaking point. Because what happens when the exhaustion of faking it becomes too heavy to bear?
The system breaks.
Right. When the gap between the brilliant mind and the failing execution demands an escape route, you can't just power down. The brain demands relief. And that leads us directly to the ultimate structural collapse, which is the focus of the second phase of this map. Long addiction, short recovery.
The hostile takeover.
The hostile takeover. Because when the burden of faked competence becomes too heavy, the system frantically searches for an off-ramp. And that is exactly where addiction enters the map.
The source material offers a radical reframe of addiction here. I mean, it completely changes the paradigm of how we view substance abuse or behavioral addictions.
The quote from the text is just incredible. You don't have an addiction problem, you have a relief problem, and your brain learned the lesson too well.
You have a relief problem. Just think about the empathy embedded in that statement. It takes the moral judgment out of addiction instantly. We stop looking at the addict and asking, why are you choosing to destroy your life? Why are you being so selfish?
Right.
And we start asking, what immense, unbearable pain are you desperately trying to escape?
It reminds me of another incredible image that the author uses, which I honestly cannot stop thinking about. He says that active addiction is survival at speed. He writes, the substance is the motorcycle ridden to escape the gravity of trauma.
Survival at speed. That implies that the addiction is not a senseless act of self-destruction. In the beginning, it is actually serving a vital function.
It's a coping mechanism.
Right, it's a coping mechanism. The faked competence is a crushing gravity. And the substance, whether it's alcohol, opioids, gambling, workaholism, is the motorcycle providing the escape velocity needed to get away from the crushing weight of the self model.
But eventually, the motorcycle drives you off a cliff.
Yes.
The relief becomes the captor. The text describes addiction not as a broken part in the brain, but as a hostile takeover.
Yeah.
That is a very specific structural term. What does a hostile takeover look like neurologically?
Well, the briefing note insists that addiction is not a malfunction of broken parts. It is a capture of perfectly healthy circuitry.
Wait, healthy circuitry?
Yes. Your brain has deeply evolved, highly efficient circuits designed to maintain order, to seek life-sustaining rewards, to ensure your survival. In addiction, those exact healthy circuits are hijacked, remodeled, and pushed into a self-reinforcing pathological order. The machinery is working perfectly. It has just been aimed at the wrong target.
Pathological order. That feels like an oxymoron.
Yeah.
Because when we think of addiction, we think of pure chaos. We think of a life completely out of control, falling apart at the seams. How is that order?
Well, it looks like chaos from the outside. The lost jobs, the ruined relationships, the financial ruin that is chaotic to the observer. But internally, neurologically, the system has found a new, incredibly rigid way to organize itself.
Okay.
The entire triad knowledge values agency is reorganized around a single prime directive: acquire the substance. The author contrasts this with adaptive order. Health is not static perfection. Health is a dynamic, self-correcting equilibrium.
Like a healthy ecosystem.
Exactly. An ecosystem constantly adjusts to changes in weather, predators, resources. But a brain locked in the rigidity of addiction is just as dysfunctional as a brain in total random chaos. It is a frozen system.
So when society labels addiction as a disorder, the text says we must pause and ask a pivotal question: out of whose order?
Because the addict's brain has found an order. It's just a pathological one that is slowly destroying the host. It's a hostile takeover of the self-modeling system. The internal auditor has been tied up and thrown in the trunk, and the addiction is now driving the car.
Wow. Okay, so if the addiction is a structural hijack, but it makes perfect logical sense that the cure, the recovery, must be structural engineering.
Yes.
You can't just wish a hijacked building back into the hands of its rightful owners. You can't just use white-knuckle endurance to fight off a hostile takeover.
No, you can't outthink a captured brain using the very brain that is captured.
Right. That is the core message here. Recovery is not a moral conversion where you suddenly see the light and become a good person. It is structural rebuilding. And critically, a damaged system cannot fix itself in isolation. A fragile prefrontal cortex cannot repair a hijacked reward system all by itself. It needs external scaffolding.
We mentioned scaffolding earlier, the idea of putting steel supports around a crumbling building. What does this scaffolding actually look like in practice for a human being in recovery?
The text explores two key mechanisms for this, right?
Yes. The first scaffold is accountability, but we have to completely strip away how we normally use that word. Usually accountability means someone yells at you, you feel guilty, and you promise to do better.
Right, it's very punitive.
Exactly. But the author reframes accountability as a literal neural ledger. He traces the word back to its Latin root, computare, which means to prune, to reckon, and to render.
Like an accountant going over the books of a corrupt corporation.
Precisely. Accountability is not an apology. It is keeping honest books on a life. You have to reckon with the stark reality of your actions. You have to systematically prune away the lies and the faked competence you've spent years building. And you must render an accurate account of your behavior to the world. You are literally rewiring the brain to tolerate the truth without seeking the relief of the motorcycle.
Okay, so if accountability, the neural ledger, is the first scaffold, what is the second? Because an accountant can tell you you're bankrupt, but that doesn't put money back in the bank.
Very true. The second scaffold is the social identity model of recovery, or SIMOR. Remember how we discussed that the knowledge values agency triad is naturally scaffolded by social identity?
Yeah.
Well, when you are attempting to rebuild a shattered triad, you must anchor it in a new social identity. You have to surround yourself with other people who reflect back to you the new model you were trying to construct.
So you're kind of borrowing their stability.
In the most literal sense, you are borrowing their prefrontal cortexes. You are borrowing their executive functioning, their stability, and their capacity for truth, while your own internal structures are healing.
Which brings us back to the idea that the undivided life is kept, not won. There is no finish line where you get a diploma that says, I'm cured.
Right. There's no blood test or brain scan that can declare a person definitively recovered. You measure recovery against clinical scaffolding, sure, but essentially you are building a self-correcting life.
And this is where the narrative takes a really challenging turn, because that transition out of the chaotic pathological order of addiction into a self-correcting life is where the real work begins. Removing the substance is just the demolition phase. Now you have to actually build.
Exactly. Because once you remove the substance, once you take away the motorcycle, the gravity of the trauma, the exhaustion of the functioning stranger, and the problem of the self doesn't just magically vanish, it mutates.
Right. You no longer have the distraction or the numbing agent of the active addiction. Now you are completely sober, sitting in a quiet room, and you have to face the person you're actually becoming.
And this takes us into the territory of the third book, The Stranger and the Scanner. And it moves us from mechanics into what the author calls the meaning book.
I really want to talk about the title of that book,
sure,
because it is based on a piece of neuroimaging data that just absolutely blew my mind.
The fMRI study.
Yes. So the text explains that when you put a person in an fMRI scanner, a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine that tracks blood flow in the brain, and you ask them to think about their future self, their brain lights up in a very specific, very telling way. It lights up exactly as if they're looking at a completely different person, a stranger.
It is a stunning revelation about how our minds operate across time. Neurologically speaking, your brain does not view your future self as you. It processes your future self as a distinct entity, separate from your current consciousness.
Wait, so if I think about myself 10 years from now, my brain is using the exact same neural pathways it uses when I think about, like, a guy I just passed on the street.
Literally. Yes.
And the implications of that are massive. Because if your future self is processed by the brain as a stranger, then the future self is not a destination you are simply traveling toward on a timeline. It is a relationship.
Right. And like any relationship with another human being, it can either be neglected, which the text calls drift, or it can be tended to and nurtured, which it calls navigate.
Drift versus navigate. That is the core conflict of the third book. But I want to stop here and push back on something the author claims.
Okay, go for it.
The text talks about the trap of the next self, and it warns heavily against the desire for self-reinvention. But hold on. We celebrate reinvention in our culture, the whole new year, new you phenomenon.
Oh, absolutely.
If someone is stuck in a dead-end town, surrounded by toxic people who enable their worst habits, moving to a new city, starting a new career, and becoming a new person is literally how they save their own life. How is starting fresh a bad thing? How is that drifting? That sounds like taking ultimate control of your navigation.
It's a vital distinction to make, and it's a great question. Changing your environment to support the health of the self you currently have is absolutely navigation. But the reinvention the author warns against is different. It is a psychological trap. It is the desire to completely abandon the current messy self.
Okay, I see.
For the functioning stranger, once they are sober, or once they have stopped whatever exhausting behavior they were using to cope, the fidelity problem doesn't disappear. It migrates. The text says that the next self becomes the new affair partner.
The new affair partner. That is a brutal way to put it.
But it is incredibly seductive when you declare, I am going to completely reinvent myself. I'm throwing away my past. I'm becoming an entirely new person. It feels incredibly powerful. It feels like you are steering your life with purpose.
But it's an illusion.
It is. The author argues that this is actually drift wearing the costume of growth. It is the creation of a shiny, unaudited model that promises a clean, painless escape from the complicated, damaged self you actually have. Reinvention, in this pathological sense, is a way to avoid keeping faith with the stranger you are actually becoming.
It's always easier to abandon the difficult renovation project and just buy a new plot of land.
Right. But you bring the same faulty blueprints with you to the new city.
So constantly jumping to the next beautifully named project, the next city, the next relationship, the next fitness fad that is just chaos dressed as freedom. It is the system abandoning its model rather than doing the grueling, unglamorous work of updating it.
Precisely. And to understand why we fall into this trap of endless reinvention, the briefing notes spend significant time unpacking the specific mental machinery at play. It outlines three philosophical and mental engines that dictate whether we drift or navigate.
Right. Value sedimentation, the captured audit, and the triad of Eros, Chronos, and Finds. Okay, those are massive concepts. We need to take these one by one and really ground them in reality. Let's start with value sedimentation. What is that, and how does it keep us drifting?
Remember earlier when we talked about the self model, and we said that values are the felt weightings baked into your perception. They dictate what matters to your brain.
Right, the motivational weight.
Value sedimentation occurs when outdated, historically necessary predictions get permanently locked into your model, even after the environment has changed.
Give me an example of what that looks like in a person's life.
Okay, imagine a child growing up in a highly volatile, unpredictable household. Every time that child speaks up or expresses a need, they are met with anger or rejection.
Okay.
The child's brain, which is a brilliant survival machine, bakes in evaluating. Staying quiet and invisible equals safety and survival. That is a highly adaptive value for that specific environment.
It keeps them safe.
Exactly. But 30 years later, that child is a 40-year-old executive sitting in a safe boardroom. They have brilliant ideas, but every time they try to speak, their throat tightens and they remain silent. That outdated prediction that speaking equals danger has sedimented into their self-model. It is directing their behavior in the present, even though the threat is long gone.
So you have the knowledge that you are in a safe boardroom, but the sedimented value of staying invisible completely overrides it, which severs your agency. You are drifting on the currents of childhood trauma, thinking you are making adult choices.
Exactly. It is the quiet, invisible engine that holds the knower and the doer apart.
Okay, what about the second engine, the captured audit? We talk about accountability as a neural ledger keeping honest books. What does it mean when the audit is captured?
This might be the most dangerous mechanism of all. A self-model that has spent decades teaching itself to lie, performing faked competence, hiding the gap, hiding the addiction, constantly masking, cannot be its own sole auditor. The body's ledger cannot indict itself.
It's like a wildly corrupt police department being put in charge of investigating its own officers. They're going to clear themselves of all wrongdoing every single time.
That is the perfect analogy. If you are the corrupt accountant, you can't be trusted to do the audit. You know all the tricks to hide the missing funds. The text says that a captured audit doesn't just cook the books, it fires the internal auditor entirely. You lose the internal alarm system that tells you when you are drifting.
Which means correction must come from the outside. You need an external auditor to come in and force you to look at the books. But if you have spent your whole life faking competence, letting someone else see the books is your worst nightmare.
Yes. Which is why trust, once it is broken internally, is so incredibly difficult to rebuild.
That sets up a terrifying catch-22, which we will get to in a moment. But first, let's look at the third engine the author maps out, which sounds like something straight out of a Greek tragedy. Eros, Kronos, Fides.
It is the philosophical engine of the whole project, and it beautifully ties the biology to the human soul. Eros represents longing. It is our desires, our hunger, what we reach for in life. Kronos represents finitude. It is the heavy, inescapable pressure of finite time, the reality that we are aging, that opportunities are closing, that time is running out.
And Fides.
Fides represents fidelity, keeping faith. The author argues that a navigable life requires the tension of all three.
How do they interact?
Longing Eros under the pressure of finite time, Kronos, must be held steady by fidelity Fides. If any one of those three collapses, the whole system fails. If you have Eros and Kronos but no Fides, you have longing under pressure with no fidelity. You just constantly chase the next self, jumping from obsession to obsession as time runs out.
And if you have Fides and Kronos but no Eros? If you have fidelity and time but no longing?
Then you have rigid static order. Mm. You are white-knuckling through life out of pure duty, maintaining the machinery but experiencing zero joy or vitality. Fidelity without longing is a prison.
Wow. So true fidelity Fides is the resolution. The text defines it as truth is troth. Agency is fidelity enacted in the real world. It is keeping faith with a future self you can actually live with. It makes me think of the analogy of a carpenter's wheel. For a wheel to run true, it can't just be built once and forgotten. It lives only by continuous micro-corrections as it rolls over the terrain.
A constancy that lives only by continuous correction, that is adaptive order.
But when we talk about Kronos, about the pressure of finite time, it can feel a bit morbid, like we are just sitting around watching the clock tick down to the end of our lives.
Oh.
But the author introduces a signature reframe here called the next 20, and he says it is a fractal horizon. What does a fractal horizon actually mean in terms of how we live?
When we hear the next 20, we usually think of the last 20 years of a human lifespan, which feels like a death countdown reserved for the elderly. But the author says the next 20 is fractal, meaning the pattern is exactly the same no matter how close or far you lay in. It can mean the next 20 years, the next 20 days, the next 20 hours, or the next 20 minutes. Finitude is a lens available at any age.
So in the next 20 minutes of my life, do I drift or do I navigate? When my alarm goes off tomorrow morning, in those next 20 seconds, do I choose the quick relief of hitting snooze, or do I make a tiny deposit into the account of the stranger I am becoming?
Exactly.
The choice to keep faith is alive in every single increment of time.
And that brings us to the ultimate resolution of the meaning book. We are left with a three-state spectrum of human existence. You can exist in disorder, which is a model abandon. This is chaos dressed as freedom, constantly drifting, chasing the next self. You can exist in static order, which is a model frozen. This is rigid, never updated, white-knuckling through life, surviving but not living. Or you can achieve adaptive order, a model that holds its line by self-correcting, living fidelity, navigation.
Which perfectly sets up the final piece of this massive puzzle, because to successfully navigate, to actually keep faith with that stranger in the scanner, to continuously self-correct the wheel, you need one single hidden load-bearing value, a value that connects the entire trilogy from the intention-action gap through the addiction all the way to the future self.
We finally arrive at the keystone question, the profound question the entire map was secretly pointing toward all along.
Do you trust your present self to take good care of your future self?
That is it. That is the spine of the entire project. Self-trust.
When I first read that, I had to stop and put the briefing note down. But it also made me wonder, why did it take three books to get to this? If self-trust is the ultimate key to the intention-action gap, why not put it on page one of book one? Why bury the lead?
Because trust is invisible. As the briefing note meticulously explains, there are structural, historical reasons it stayed hidden for so long. First, it is barely studied in the grand scheme of human thought. Moral philosophy spent 2,500 years obsessing over promises, contracts, and justice, and said almost nothing about the mechanics of trust until the late 1980s.
That's wild.
And second, and more importantly, trust is transparent. It is like the self model we talked about earlier, or like air. You look through it, not at it.
You only notice air when it gets knocked out of your lungs.
Exactly. Working trust has no felt texture. When you sit in a chair, you don't actively think, I trust this chair to hold my weight. You just sit. Trust is the invisible assumption of structural integrity.
And when you don't trust yourself, you don't walk around consciously thinking, I lack self-trust.
Yes.
You don't feel the absence of the trust. You feel the symptoms of the collapse.
That is why it hides. It hides behind its proxies. You feel the crushing procrastination. You feel the shame of the broken promise to your kids. You feel the frantic need to reach for the drink. The diagnosis usually stops at the symptom. We say, oh, they have a time management problem or they have a drinking problem, because trust operates one level deeper in the foundation.
And for the functioning stranger we talked about at the very beginning, the highly capable person holding it all together, sending the emails, hitting the targets, self-trust is their exact, perfectly protected blind spot. Their entire mask of competence, their fierce independence and self-sufficiency is actually a complex machine designed to rote around trust. They say, I need no one, because they don't even trust themselves.
The author uses a great phrase here. The fish is the last to find water. The more capable the fish, the faster it swims, the longer it survives without ever looking for the water it is swimming in. Keystones are found last by structural necessity. You cannot see the keystone until the arch is nearly built and the scaffolding is removed. That is why it took three books to surface.
Okay, but this brings us back to that terrifying catch-22 we mentioned earlier. If your internal audit is captured, if you have spent years lying to yourself and you fundamentally do not trust yourself, how do you ever regain it? Because the text drops a line here that I think is just devastating. It says, the hardest thing a human ever does is letting someone you have decided not to trust tell you the truth about yourself and acting on it before the wall arrives.
Think about the sheer magnitude of that statement. The hardest human act.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't trust yourself, you have fired the internal auditor. So the truth about your life must come from the outside. It has to. But because you are deeply structurally distrustful, you'll immediately try to discredit any external auditor who tries to help you. A therapist, a spouse, a best friend. The moment they point out your gap, your brain will find a reason why they don't understand you, why they are biased, why they are wrong.
You will use your brilliant 2E Ferrari engine to completely dismantle their argument so you don't have to face the truth.
Yes. So how does an author reach a reader whose defenses are that highly sophisticated? How do you bypass a captured audit?
By using his own life. This is where the entire map shifts from theory to something deeply personal. This brings us to the emotional ground of the trilogy. Neil W. Smith is not a detached clinician in a white lab coat studying a population of broken people from above. He is a late vocation neuroscience student who intimately lived the very gap he is mapping.
The source gives us a glimpse into his personal narrative, and it is haunting. It grounds all this high-level neuroscience in flesh and blood. As a teenager, he was brilliant. He read Thoreau and Eliot. He swore he would live a deliberate life. He promised himself he would not live a life of quiet desperation. He had the knowledge, and he had the values.
But then the agency collapsed.
He fell into the gap. He lost decades to severe drinking. He lost marriages, a career, a home. His self quietly, structurally came apart behind a competent exterior.
And the briefing note reveals that when he finally woke up, sober, nearing the age of 70, he realized something horrifying. Mm. The substance, the motorcycle was gone, but nothing had actually stopped. The fundamental exhaustion, the longing, the fidelity problem was still standing exactly where it had always stood. That realization is what generated the bookend quote of the entire trilogy.
Right.
I knew everything, it changed nothing.
I knew everything, it changed nothing. That is the ultimate heartbreaking distillation of the functioning stranger's agony. Knowledge without agency. And by putting that out there, by making his own catastrophic failure the primary case study, the author is doing something incredibly clever with the format of the book itself. The book is not just a collection of neurobiological facts. It is a delivery system.
It is a trust delivery system. Because if a reader with a captured audit sits in a therapist's office, they feel confronted. They feel judged. They will immediately put up their shields. But when you are sitting alone in your room reading a book, you aren't being confronted. You are overhearing. You are overhearing a narrator indict himself. You can't discredit the auditor because the auditor is confessing his own worst-case scenario.
The author earns the right to be heard by going first, by admitting his own absolute worst. He slips past the reader's lock of distrust by never triggering it. And importantly, he maintains an honest, structural uncertainty. He doesn't act like a self-help guru who is absolutely certain he has the magic pill to save you. The text sharply notes that the guru who is certain he is saving you has stopped auditing himself.
And this leads to what the text brilliantly calls the borrowed wall. The author's wager, his hope for this entire project, is that a reader can achieve deep flourishing without having to hit their own devastating rock bottom first. You can feel the bone-shattering consequences of the intention-action gap by watching the narrator collide with the wall at full speed. You borrow his wall so you don't have to crash your own car.
It is an act of profound, hard-won generosity. The measure of success for this trilogy isn't that everyone who reads it is magically, instantly saved from their struggles. The measure of success is that an honestly built door now exists. A mapped way out of the gap, out of the pathological order of addiction, and into a life of navigation.
We have covered an immense landscape today, from the deepest neurology of the brain to the philosophy of time and fidelity. Let's briefly zoom out and connect the continuous arc of this map for everyone listening. We started with the wiring, the intention-action gap, the Ferrari engine on the bicycle transmission, the crushing daily exhaustion of faked competence, and the fractured triad of knowledge, values, and agency. Then we mapped the way out. Understanding addiction not as a moral failing, but as a hostile takeover, a relief problem that requires external structural scaffolding, a neural ledger, and a new social identity to rebuild.
And finally, we looked at the road ahead. The realization that the future self is processed as a stranger in the scanner, and the lifelong challenge is to navigate rather than drift, maintaining fidelity against the seductive, drifting trap of the next self.
And tying all of that together, from beginning to end, is that invisible, load-bearing spine of self-trust. Can the self you are today be trusted with the self you are becoming? Because as the author so wisely states, the undivided life is kept, not won.
Kept, not won. It is not a trophy you polish and put on a shelf, dusting your hands and saying, I'm fixed. It is a wheel that must continuously, actively self-correct to run true. It requires adaptive order.
It demands a profound shift in perspective. To finally stop viewing yourself as a broken, lazy, moral entity and to start viewing yourself as a dynamic, capable system worthy of structural repair.
It really is a complete rewiring of how to view a human life.
It is. And as we wrap up our deep dive into this incredible material, I want to bring it all back to where we started, to that feeling in the quiet moments. If you are listening to this and you know the exact exhaustion we've been talking about, if you have been faking competence and waiting for the other shoe to drop, I want to leave you with one final lingering thought to mull over. We talked about the next 20s to do, the idea that finitude is fractal.
The choice to navigate is alive in every single moment.
Exactly. So here's the question for you to take with you into the rest of your day. When you close your eyes and picture the stranger you will become in exactly 20 minutes, or 20 days. What is one tiny structural piece of scaffolding you can build today, right now, to prove to that stranger that you finally have their back?